Passage 16.
The deepest holes of all are made for oil, and they go down to as much as 25,000 feet. But we do not need to send men down to get the oil out, as we must with other mineral deposits. The holes are only borings, less than a foot in diameter. My particular experience is largely in oil, and the search for oil has done more to improve deep drilling than any other mining activity. When it has been decided where we are going to drill, we put up at the surface an oil derrick. It has to be tall because it is like a giant block and tackle, and we have to lower into the ground and haul out of the ground great lengths of drill pipe, which are rotated by an engine at the top and are fitted with a cutting bit at the bottom. The geologist needs to know what rocks the drill has reached, so every so often a sample is obtained with a coring bit. It cuts a clean cylinder of rock, from which can be seen the strata the drill has been cutting through. Once we get down to the oil, it usually flows to the surface because great pressure, either from gas or water, is pushing it. This pressure must be under control, and we control it by means of the mud, which we circulate down the drill pipe. We endeavor to avoid the old, romantic idea of a gusher, which wastes oil and gas. We want it to stay down the hole until we can lead it off in a controlled manner. T. F. Gaskell, The Search for the Earth's Minerals, from Discovery. Passage 17.
The fact that we are not sure what intelligence is, nor what it is passed on, does not prevent us from finding it a very useful working concept, and placing a certain amount of reliance on tests which measure it. In an intelligence test, we take a sample of an individual's ability to solve puzzles and problems of various kinds. And if we have taken a representative sample, it will allow us to predict successfully the level of performance he will reach in a wide variety of occupations. This became of particular importance when, as a result of the 1944 Education Act, secondary schooling for all became law, and grammar schools, with the exception of a small number of independent foundation schools, became available to the whole population. Since the number of grammar schools in the country could accommodate at most approximately 25% of the total child population of 11 plus, some kind of selection had to be made. Narrowly academic examinations and tests were felt, quite rightly, to be heavily weighted in favor of children who had had the advantage of highly academic primary schools and academically biased homes. Intelligence tests were devised to counteract this narrow specialization by introducing problems which were not based on specifically scholastically acquired knowledge. The intelligence test is an attempt to assess the general ability of any child to think, reason, judge, analyze, and synthesize by presenting him with situations, both verbal and practical, which are within his range of competence and understanding. Beatrix Tudor Hart, Learning to Live. Passage 18.
Two factors weigh heavily against the effectiveness of scientific research in industry. One is the general atmosphere of secrecy in which it is carried out, the other the lack of freedom of the individual research worker. Insofar as any inquiry is a secret one, it naturally limits all those engaged in carrying it out from effective contact with their fellow scientists, either in other countries or in universities, or even, often enough, in other departments of the same firm. The degree of secrecy naturally varies considerably. Some of the bigger firms are engaged in researches which are of such general and fundamental nature that it is a positive advantage to them not to keep them secret. Yet, a great many processes depending on such research are sought for with complete secrecy until the stage at which patents can be taken out. Even more processes are never patented at all, but kept as secret processes. This applies particularly to chemical industries, where chance discoveries play a much larger part than they do in physical and mechanical industries. Sometimes the secrecy goes to such an extent that the whole nature of the research cannot be mentioned. Many firms, for instance, have great difficulty in obtaining technical or scientific books from libraries because they are unwilling to have their names entered as having taken out such and such a book for fear the agents of other firms should be able to trace the kind of research they are likely to be undertaking. J.D. Burnell, The Social Function of Science. Passage 19.
A gentleman is rather than does. He is interested in nothing in a professional way. He is allowed to cultivate hobbies, even eccentricities, but must not practice a vocation. He must know how to ride and shoot and cast a fly. He should have relatives in the army and navy, and at least one connection in the diplomatic service. But there are weaknesses in the English gentleman's ability to rule us today. He usually knows nothing of political economy, and less about how foreign countries are governed. He doesn't respect learning and prefers sport. The problem set for society is not the virtues of the type so much as its adequacy for its function. And here grave difficulties arise. He refuses to consider sufficiently the wants of the customer, who must buy not the thing he desires, but the thing the English gentleman wants to sell. He attends inadequately to technological development. Disbelieving in the necessity of large-scale production in the modern world, he is passionately devoted to excessive secrecy, both in finance and method of production. He has an incurable and widespread nepotism in appointment, discounting ability and relying upon a mystic entity called character, which means in a gentleman's mouth the qualities he traditionally possesses himself. His lack of imagination and narrowness of his social loyalties have ranged against him one of the fundamental estates of the realm. He is incapable of that imaginative realism which admits that this is a new world to which he must adjust himself and its institutions. That every privilege he formerly took as of right, he can now attain only by offering proof that it is directly relevant to social welfare. T.H. Pear, English Social Differences. Passage 20.
In the organization of industrial life, the influence of the factory upon the physiological and mental state of the workers has been completely neglected. Modern industry is based on the conception of the maximum production at lowest cost, in order that an individual or a group of individuals may earn as much money as possible. It has expanded without any idea of the true nature of the human beings who run the machines, and without giving any consideration to the effects produced on the individuals and on their descendants by the artificial mode of existence imposed by the factory. The great cities have been built with no regard for us. The shape and dimensions of the skyscrapers depend entirely on the necessity of obtaining the maximum income per square foot of ground and of offering to the tenants offices and apartments that please them. This caused the construction of gigantic buildings where two large masses of human beings are crowded together. Civilized men like such a way of living. While they enjoy the comfort and banal luxury of their dwelling, they do not realize that they are deprived of the necessities of life. The modern city consists of monstrous edifices and of dark, narrow streets full of petrol fumes, coal dust, and toxic gases, torn by the noise of the taxicabs, lorries, and buses, and thronged ceaselessly by great crowds. Obviously, it has not been planned for the good of its inhabitants. Alexis Carroll, Man, the Unknown. Unit 3, Passage 21.
In the early days of the settlement of Australia, enterprising settlers unwisely introduced the European rabbit. This rabbit had no natural enemies in the Antipodes, so that it multiplied with that promiscuous abandon characteristic of rabbits. It overran a whole continent. It caused devastation by burrowing and by devouring the herbage, which might have maintained millions of sheep and cattle. Scientists discovered that this particular variety of rabbit, and apparently no other animal, was susceptible to a fatal virus disease, myxomatosis. By infecting animals and letting them loose in the burrows, local epidemics of this disease could be created. Later, it was found that there was a type of mosquito which acted as the carrier of this disease and passed it on to the rabbits. So while the rest of the world was trying to get rid of mosquitoes, Australia was encouraging this one. It effectively spread the disease all over the continent and drastically reduced the rabbit population. It later became apparent that rabbits were developing a degree of resistance to this disease, so that the rabbit population was unlikely to be completely exterminated. There were hopes, however, that the problem of the rabbit would become manageable. Ironically, Europe, which had bequeathed the rabbit as a pest to Australia, acquired this man-made disease as a pestilence. A French physician decided to get rid of the wild rabbits on his own estate and introduce myxomatosis. It did not, however, remain within the confines of his estate. It spread through France, where wild rabbits are not generally regarded as a pest, but as a sport and a useful food supply, and it spread to Britain, where wild rabbits are regarded as a pest, but where domesticated rabbits, equally susceptible to the disease, are the basis of a profitable fur industry. The question became one of whether man could control the disease he'd invented. Richie Calder, Science Makes Sense. Passage 22.
There has long been a superstition among mariners that porpoises will save drowning men by pushing them to the surface, or protect them from sharks by surrounding them in defensive formation. Marine studio biologists have pointed out that, however intelligent they may be, it is probably a mistake to credit dolphins with any motive of life-saving. On the occasions when they have pushed ashore an unconscious human being, they have much more likely done it out of curiosity or for sport, as in riding the bow waves of a ship. In 1928, some porpoises were photographed working like beavers to push ashore a waterlogged mattress. If, as has been reported, they have protected humans from sharks, it may have been because curiosity attracted them, and because the scent of a possible meal attracted the sharks. Porpoises and sharks are natural enemies. It is possible that upon such an occasion a battle ensued, with the sharks being driven away or killed. Whether it be bird, fish or beast, the porpoise is intrigued with anything that is alive. They are constantly after the turtles, the Ferdinands of marine life, who peacefully submit to all sorts of indignities. One young calf especially enjoyed raising a turtle to the surface with his snout and then shoving him across the tank like an aquaplane. Almost any day, a young porpoise may be seen trying to turn a 300-pound sea turtle over by sticking his snout under the edge of his shell and pushing up for dear life. This is not easy and may require two porpoises working together. In another game, as the turtle swims across the oceanarium, the first porpoise swoops down from above and butts his shell with his belly. This knocks the turtle down several feet. He no sooner recovers his equilibrium than the next porpoise comes along and hits him another crack. Eventually, the turtle has been butted all the way down to the floor of the tank. He is now satisfied merely to try to stand up, but as soon as he does so, a porpoise knocks him flat. The turtle at last gives up by pulling his feet under his shell, and the game is over. Ralph Nading Hill, Window in the Sea. Passage 23.
It's fairly clear that the sleeping period must have some function, and because there is so much of it, the function would seem to be important. Speculations about its nature have been going on for literally thousands of years. And one odd finding that makes the problem puzzling is that it looks very much as if sleeping is not simply a matter of giving the body a rest. Rest, in terms of muscle relaxation and so on, can be achieved by a brief period lying or even sitting down. The body's tissues are self-repairing and self-restoring to a degree, and function best when more or less continuously active. In fact, a basic amount of movement occurs during sleep, which is specifically concerned with preventing muscle inactivity. If it is not a question of resting the body, then perhaps it's the brain that needs resting. This might be a plausible hypothesis, were it not for two factors. First, the electroencephalograph, which is simply a device for recording the electrical activity of the brain by attaching electrodes to the scalp, shows that while there is a change in the pattern of activity during sleep, there is no evidence that the total amount of activity is any less. The second factor is more interesting and more fundamental. In 1960, an American psychiatrist named William Dement published experiments dealing with the recording of eye movements during sleep. He showed that the average individual's sleep cycle is punctuated with peculiar bursts of eye movements, some drifting and slow, others jerky and rapid. People woken during these periods of eye movements generally reported that they had been dreaming. When woken at other times, they reported no dreams. If one group of people were disturbed from their eye movement sleep for several nights on end, and another group were disturbed for an equal period of time, but when they were not exhibiting eye movements, the first group began to show some personality disorders, while the others seemed more or less unaffected. The implications of all this were that it was not the disturbance of sleep that mattered, but the disturbance of dreaming. Christopher Evans, The Stuff of Dreams from The Listener. Passage 24.
Walking for walking's sake may be as highly laudable and exemplary a thing as it is held to be by those who practice it. My objection to it is that it stops the brain. Many a man has professed to me that his brain never works so well as when he is swinging along the high road or over hill and dale. This boast is not confirmed by my memory of anybody who, on a Sunday morning, has forced me to partake of his adventure. Experience teaches me that whatever a fellow guest may have of power to instruct or to amuse when he is sitting in a chair or standing on a hearth rug, quickly leaves him when he takes one out for a walk. The ideas that come so thick and fast to him in any room, where are they now? Where that encyclopedic knowledge which he bore so lightly? Where the kindling fancy that played like a summer lightning over any topic that was started? The man's face that was so mobile is set now. Gone is the light from his fine eyes. He says that A, our host, is a thoroughly good fellow. 50 yards further on, he adds that A is one of the best fellows he has ever met. We tramp another furlong or so, and he says that Mrs. A is a charming woman. Presently, he adds that she is one of the most charming women he has ever known. We pass an inn. He reads vapidly aloud to me, "The King's Arms, license to sell ales and spirits." I foresee that during the rest of the walk he will read aloud any inscription that occurs. We pass a milestone. He points at it with his stick and says, "Uxminster, 11 miles. We turn a sharp corner at foot of the hill. He points at the wall and says, "Drive slowly." I see far ahead on the other side of the hedge bordering the high road a small notice board. He sees it too. He keeps his eye on it. And in due course, "Trespassers," he says, "will be prosecuted." Poor man. Mentally a wreck. Max Beerbohm, Going Out for a Walk. Passage 25.
How it came about that snakes manufactured poison is a mystery. Over the periods, their saliva, a mild digestive juice just like our own, was converted into a poison that defies analysis even today. It was not forced upon them by a survival competition. They could have caught and lived on prey without using poison, just as the thousands of non-poisonous snakes still do. Poison to a snake is merely a luxury. It enables it to get its food with very little effort, no more effort than one bite. And why only snakes? Cats, for instance, would be greatly helped. No running fights with large, fierce rats or tussles with grown rabbits. Just a bite, and no more effort needed. In fact, it would be an assistance to all the carnivori, though it would be a two-edged weapon when they fought each other. But of the vertebrates, unpredictable nature selected only snakes, and one lizard. One wonders also why nature, with some snakes, concocted poison of such extreme potency. In the conversion of saliva into poison, one might suppose that a fixed process took place. It did not. Some snakes manufactured a poison different in every respect from that of others, as different as arsenic is from strychnine, having different effects. One poison acts on the nerves, the other on the blood. The maker of the nerve poison includes the mambas and the cobras, and their venom is called neurotoxic. Vipers, adders, and rattlesnakes manufacture the blood poison, which is known as hemolytic. Both poisons are unpleasant, but by far the more unpleasant is the blood poison. It is said that the nerve poison is the more primitive of the two, that the blood poison is, so to speak, a newer product from an improved formula. Be that as it may, the nerve poison does its business with man far more quickly than the blood poison. This, however, means nothing. Snakes did not acquire their poison for use against man, but for use against prey, such as rats and mice. And the effects on these of viperine poison is almost immediate. John Crompton, The Snake. Passage 26.
William S. Hart was, perhaps, the greatest of all Western stars, for unlike Gary Cooper and John Wayne, he appeared in nothing but Westerns. From 1914 to 1924, he was supreme and unchallenged. It was Hart who created the basic formula of the Western film, and devised the protagonist he played in every film he made, the good bad man, the accidental noble outlaw, or the honest but framed cowboy, or the sheriff made suspect by vicious gossip. In short, the individual in conflict with himself and his frontier environment. Unlike most of his contemporaries in Hollywood, Hart actually knew something of the Old West. He had lived in it as a child when it was already disappearing, and his hero was firmly rooted in his memories and experiences, and in both the history and the mythology of the vanished frontier. And although no period or place in American history has been more absurdly romanticized, myth and reality did join hands in at least one arena, the conflict between the individual and encroaching civilization. Men accustomed to struggling for survival against the elements and Indians were bewildered by politicians, bankers, and businessmen, and unhorsed by fences, laws, and alien taboos. Hart's good bad man was always an outsider, always one of the disinherited, and if he found it necessary to shoot a sheriff or rob a bank along the way, his early audiences found it easy to understand and forgive, especially when it was Hart who, in the end, overcame the attacking Indians. Audiences in the second decade of the 20th century found it pleasant to escape to a time when life, though hard, was relatively simple. We still do, living in a world in which undeclared aggression, war, hypocrisy, chicanery, anarchy, and impending immolation are part of our daily lives. We all want a code to live by. Carl Foreman, Virtue and a Fast Gun, from The Observer. Passage 27.
Why does the idea of progress loom so large in the modern world? Surely because progress of a particular kind is actually taking place around us and is becoming more and more manifest. Although mankind has undergone no general improvement in intelligence or morality, it has made extraordinary progress in the accumulation of knowledge. Knowledge began to increase as soon as the thoughts of one individual could be communicated to another by means of speech. With the invention of writing, a great advance was made. The knowledge could then be not only communicated, but also stored. Libraries made education possible, and education in its turn added to libraries. The growth of knowledge followed a kind of compound interest law, which was greatly enhanced by the invention of printing. All this was comparatively slow until, with the coming of science, the tempo was suddenly raised. Then knowledge began to be accumulated according to a systematic plan. The trickle became a stream. The stream has now become a torrent. Moreover, as soon as new knowledge is acquired, it is now turned to practical account. What is called modern civilization is not the result of a balanced development of all man's nature, but of accumulated knowledge applied to practical life. The problem now facing humanity is, what is going to be done with all this knowledge? As is so often pointed out, knowledge is a two-edged weapon, which can be used equally for good or evil. It is now being used indifferently for both. Could any spectacle, for instance, be more grimly whimsical than that of gunners using science to shatter men's bodies, while close at hand surgeons use it to restore them? We have to ask ourselves, very seriously, what will happen if this twofold use of knowledge, with its ever-increasing power, continues? G. N. M. Tyrrell, The Personality of Man.